When the president hosted lawmakers from both sides of the aisle to talk health care this past week, he may have unintentionally created a new presidential tradition, the televised summit. Mr. Obama invited Republican critics and the cameras into Blair House, the guest house right next to the White House, to see if he could find some common ground with opponents of his health care plan.
If we're not engaging in sort of the tit for tat and trying to score political points during the next several hours, that we might be able to make some progress.
The differences, of course, were not bridged. No one was persuaded either way. And some political strategists are now wondering whether President Obama's approach is too friendly. Simply put, could he stand to learn a thing or two from Lyndon Johnson or Richard Nixon? Presidential historian Robert Dalek might have the answer. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Nice to be with you.
Is there any historical precedent for what took place at Blair House this week?
Yeah. Well, you know, presidents always called in leaders of the Congress, and they would meet with these leaders privately. But to have televised sessions in which a president was pressuring congressmen, senators to sign on to a major piece of legislation, that's unprecedented.
I want to play a brief clip. This is an exchange between President Obama and John McCain.
This would probably be a good time to turn it over to Secretary Sebelius. Who...
Could I just say, Mr. President, the American people care about what we did and
well,
how we did it.
I think it's a subject that we should discuss, and I thank you. They absolutely do care about it, John.
And Robert Dalek, can you recall a time when legislators were able to interact with the president in such an informal way? I mean, it's almost like the way they do in Britain with the Prime Minister.
Yes, that's what I was thinking, that it's like question and answer session in the Parliament.
I mean, has this ever happened as far as you
well,
know?
Well, it happens all the time in private. When Lyndon Johnson was trying to get civil rights passed, he called in George Wallace from Alabama, sat him down in the Oval Office, and chewed him out.
We often hear parallels between what Lyndon Johnson did with Medicare and Medicaid and what President Obama is trying to do with health care. But Lyndon Johnson, I mean, he would strong-arm legislators. He was going to steamroll you.
He was going to steamroll you. He was going to push you into the corner. You know, there was the famous Johnson treatment. He'd bend you over, and somebody once said, you knew when Lyndon began breathing in your mouth that you were finished.
Mm-hmm. I mean, he was literally a towering figure.
Oh, 6 foot 3.5 inches tall, and he would tower over people, and he would use that physical size to intimidate.
If Obama tried to do that, or even George W. Bush, if they tried to do that today, they couldn't, right?
No, I mean, it'd be front page news. It would be a scandal, so to speak. But it is such a different period in our history in the relations between the president and the Congress. And the difficulty I feel that President Obama is having is creating a consensus. Consensus is vitally important if you're going to pass some major piece of legislation. He's having a terrible time doing it.
I mean, do you think that looking back on all the presidents you've written about, do you think this president has the capacity for the kind of tough tactics that you need to get things done in Washington?
Oh, Guy, I think he's learning. And my guess is now that what you're going to see is a strong-arm approach to the Republicans. And the Republicans are going to scream bloody murder as a consequence.
Ronald Reagan made God Bless America or God Bless the United States of America an almost compulsory sign-off in presidential speeches. All presidents use it now. He was really the one who started using it regularly.
Mm-hmm.
George W. Bush introduced the flag lapel pin.
Yes.
Has President Obama brought in a new tradition that every subsequent president will have to take part in? I mean, a televised Q&A session with the opposition.
This may well be a development that future presidents are going to feel.
I mean, the public is going to expect it, right?
They might. Well, you see, the way they expect debates. John Kennedy and Richard Nixon, first televised presidential debate, and ever since then, you can't escape having debates. So this may have created a standard, a precedent, and I think it's fine. This is what democracy is, and too much of it in the past has been done behind closed doors.
That's Robert Dalek. He's a presidential historian. His latest book is a biography called Harry S. Truman. Robert Dalek, thank you.
My pleasure.
About a third of uninsured adults below retirement age are between 19 and 29 years old, the so-called Young Invincibles. Many can't afford health insurance, and those who can often go without it. The reason? Well, why pay for something you might not use? So two law professors, Tom Baker from the University of Pennsylvania and Peter Siegelman from the University of Connecticut, have come up with an unusual solution. Revive the idea of tontines. These were insurance schemes banned in most states here in the U.S. at the beginning of the 20th century after a series of corruption scandals. But Tom Baker says bringing tontines back could actually encourage more people, especially the young and healthy, to buy insurance. And what exactly is a tontine?
In its very pure form, a tontine is a contribution made by a group of people to a fund, and the last one living collects all the money. And in the health context, what we're proposing is that people who are in a health insurance pool will pay a little bit extra than they would ordinarily for the health insurance, and the people in the pool who turn out not to need the health insurance during the time of the tontine, which we would say 3 years would be a good number, at the end of that 3 years, the people who didn't use their health insurance divide up among themselves the earnings on the amounts that people pay to participate in that tontine connected to the health insurance pool.
So you would essentially be gambling on your good health.
That's right. But if you think about it, insurance is a gamble. Insurance is something that you buy that pays, you know, on a contingent basis. Do you get sick or not? And from an economic perspective, it's pretty easy to prove that people really ought to be buying insurance, because insurance is a magical transformation device that allows us to shift money from times when we don't need it very much to times when we do need it very much. But it turns out that lots of people don't behave in that rational way, and we think particularly young people, because we think they're over-optimistic about their health outcomes. And so if, you know, adding a little spice to the insurance makes it more appealing, we think that's good.
You see, I see a lot of potential for mischief here, you know, like poisoning your coworkers and stuff. I mean, if you know you're all in the same pool and if they get sick and you stay healthy, you're going to make more money. I mean, my God, I can just see detectives all over this scheme.
Well, you won't be surprised to hear, and you probably know, that tontines have been a recurring theme in literature, detective novels, and I think the evidence that people have actually done that is pretty slim. There are things I am worried about, and this is something that my wife has told me about many times, is I'm concerned that someone may not go to the doctor if they're close to the end of the period and they're looking at that $1,000 or $2,000 bonus that'll be for them if they just don't go to the doctor for the next few months. And that I do worry a little bit about.
That's Tom Baker. He's a law professor at the University of Pennsylvania. He co-authored an article with Peter Siegelman from the University of Connecticut promoting tontines in the latest issue of Regulation Magazine. It's a quarterly put out by the Libertarian Cato Institute. Tom Baker, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
As I'm sure many of you are tired of hearing, the weather in parts of the East Coast this winter has been, well, pretty miserable. So a few days ago, I asked Top Chef finalist and caterer Carla Hall if she could whip up a bright and sunny dessert to take away some of the winter blues. She said yes, and so we met up at her local Safeway here in Washington to pick up the ingredients.
We're going to make a grapefruit panna cotta with mint and tarragon.
Oof.
And we're going to do a pomegranate reduction. So
wow.
Just imagine those colors.
And we're doing grapefruit now because why?
Well, because it's in season. And you think sort of in the winter all the citrus
right.
that are in season.
And I'm
season.
Looking out the window and I'm seeing like piles of snow.
Yeah. Yeah. Piles of snow and rinds of citrus. That's where we are. Oranges, grapefruits. So I chose grapefruit because so often it's kind of forgotten.
Yeah. It's like you sprinkle sugar on it and you
right.
give it to your kids for breakfast.
Exactly. Exactly. I mean, the skin is bitter, but when you're just concentrating on the pulp itself, it is amazingly wonderful.
Hmm.
Yeah. So I'm excited.
Awesome. All right. Let's go. Now, this panna cotta we're about to make also needs mint and tarragon, but this morning we run into a problem.
Okay. They don't have tarragon. I happen to have some at my house.
Perfect.
But if you had this recipe and there was no tarragon, you still move forward.
Could you use basil?
You could use basil.
Basil
has that, you know, tarragon has that sort of licorice-like taste.
Yeah.
And the basil has another sort of minty, a different minty type taste. So
yeah.
Shall we get some basil?
Why not?
Why not?
Why not?
Let's do it.
A panna cotta is basically milk and cream with some gelatin to help it set. Back in Carla's kitchen, she starts to work on the sauce first. It's a simple reduction of port wine and pomegranate juice, but you can use any fruity wine if you don't have port handy. While the wine and the juice reduce down, Carla takes out a grapefruit and does something she insists is crucial before the juicing process.
So you're rolling the grapefruit right now.
Uh-huh. I'm rolling it.
You're just rolling it on top of the cutting board.
Exactly. I'm rolling it. Put some pressure to burst those little citrus bubbles. So you see how squishy it is now? Feel that. It's kind of squishy.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, softer. And okay, I'm cutting it in half crosswise. Ooh, look at all that juice. Mm.
That juice goes into a saucepan on medium heat. You want to cook it down to about 5 tablespoons of intense grapefruit flavor.
Now, while we are doing all this, we need to get another pot. I'm going to have you measure out a cup of cream and a cup of milk.
Carla suggests you add the vanilla just as the milk starts to warm, but you don't want to cook that mixture too long, especially if you're using vanilla extract, because a lot of the flavor will simply boil off. With the milk and cream warming on the stove, it's time to chop up our basil and mint.
I want the texture of the herbs in the panna cotta, because the panna cotta is so smooth, you're going to get that nice little bite of the herbs, which will cleanse your palate at the end of dinner, which is oh so fabulous.
Mm. Yeah.
All right. So let's measure our reduction.
Carla measures out the grapefruit syrup that's been simmering on the stove.
Now, I have a bowl that's pretty wide here, and to put the juice in, because when you sprinkle the gelatin over, you want a wide surface.
Right.
Because if your surface isn't wide enough, then it's all going to clump up, and you have this thick layer as opposed to a thin layer.
She sprinkles 2 teaspoons of gelatin over the juice, gives it a quick whisk, and pours it into the warm cream. That mixture gets another few whisks, and then it all gets poured through a strainer.
We want to make sure that when we are enjoying our yummy dessert, that we're not hitting globs of gelatin.
Yeah.
Or any
globs.
Yeah, any globs. And that's just...
Who wants globs?
Who wants globs?
Finally, we stir in the herbs and take a taste.
Mmm! I'm sorry. I just love the basil! Right?
That's awesome. Yeah. It's great. I think that might even be better than tarragon. What do you think?
I love it! But you know what? I have one in the refrigerator because I had to make one before you all came. And you can taste it with the tarragon. And you've tasted this. So I am happy that they didn't have tarragon at the store.
Yeah.
Now, the mixture we've been working on will have to spend a few hours in the refrigerator. Carla pours it into greased bowls and then puts them away. And she takes out the finished version of the one she made the night before. She adds some pieces of grapefruit, the wine pomegranate reduction, and bits of candied lime peel as garnish.
Does this sound like lime peel?
No.
That's candied lime peel.
Mm.
And now it's time for a very important taste test. Basil or tarragon?
Oh, this looks so pretty. Let's dig into this one.
All right. That's delicious.
I like it.
It's great.
You know, it feels really good in your mouth, the silky texture.
Mm-hmm.
And
you know the tarragon is really nice. It does. It has that licorice-y sweetness. It is really nice.
Yeah.
You know what's nice about it is we're here in the middle of winter, right? And there's like still 1.5 feet of snow on the ground on your roof and mine. And this is so sort of like sunny and happy and warm. It's like spring has arrived early.
I know, spring has arrived early in my kitchen.
Well, Carla Hall, thank you so much.
It was my pleasure.
If you want to try making panna cotta yourself, Carla Hall's recipe is up at our website. That's npr.org. The British music magazine, NME, once called the Smiths the most influential band ever.
Shyness is nice. this, and shyness can stop you from doing all the things in life you'd like to.
The four young men from Manchester, England, led by the iconic frontman Morrissey, sang about boredom and misery and feeling awkward and literature, but always with a knowing wink. And like a lot of teenagers and young adults who came of age in the 1980s, for Peter Wilde, the Smiths defined that era.
If you'd had your heart broken, if you thought you loved someone and she wouldn't give you the time of day, if you had a thing with someone and it didn't work out, if you bumbled, felt crap, thought that the person staring back at you out of the mirror more closely resembled a gargoyle than the person you thought you were, you know, inside. If you're a teenager, basically, the argo of the Smiths was the articulation of your every inadequacy.
That's Peter Wilde reading from the introduction to a new book of short stories inspired by Smith songs. It's called Please, and Peter Wilde is the editor. Welcome to the program.
Hello, thanks for having me.
The song we've been hearing, it's called Ask, and like so many Smith songs, it already tells a story or stories. There's a line, spending warm summer days indoors, writing frightening verse to a bucktooth girl in Luxembourg. Peter Wilde, how did you get the idea to get, you know, almost two dozen writers to tell stories using songs by the Smiths as a starting point?
What happened was, over the years, I put my hand in with interviewing writers and what have you, and I've interviewed lots and lots of writers over the past decade.
You're a literary critic, I should mention.
I do a website called Bookmunch, and as a result of doing that website and interviewing writers, time and time again, I found people saying to me, oh, well, you know, when I write, I do like to have music on in the background, and I do find that the music kind of helps me write and conjures up certain things in the writing itself. And so, as I say, over a period of years, it got to me to thinking, what kinds of bands, were there bands that people turned to more than others when they actually sat down to write? And the Smiths was one of those bands that came up time and again, whether it was because of the very evocative music of Johnny Marr, really, those very, you know, evocative guitar sounds that he makes.
And Johnny Marr, of course, the guitarist for the Smiths.
Or whether it was Morrissey's lyrics. The Smiths were a band that I found writers had on in the background as they were doing their daily writing. So it came out of that.
The book is a collection of 24 stories. Smiths fans will be familiar with most of the titles. This Charming Man, Big Mouth Strikes Again, and, of course, Heaven Knows I'm Miserable Now.
What she asked of me at the end of the day, Caligula would have blushed. Oh, you've been in the house too long, she said, and I naturally fled.
Now, the short story in the book, which is obviously called Heaven Knows I'm Miserable Now, is written by a writer named Kate Pullinger. This story is about being miserable, but in a very different way, a completely different twist. Can you describe the story for us?
It's about a gentleman, a married gentleman, who appears to be having a sort of online flirtation with one of his colleagues. And on her birthday, he decides it will be a bright idea to send her a sort of JPEG of himself or a streaming movie of himself dancing naked while singing Heaven Knows I'm Miserable Now. And then what happens is, I think his daughter is ill, and so he's away from work for a few days. And when he returns to work, he finds that this bit of movie that he's filmed for his colleague has gone online and has been seen by millions and millions of people all over the world.
That would cause misery.
You would think so.
And the song by the Smiths talks about, you know, I was looking for a job and then I found a job and heaven knows I'm miserable now. It's a different story, but it sort of touches on the themes, I guess, of...
Yeah.
Workplace misery.
Yes, indeed.
I was looking for a job and then I found a job and heaven knows I'm miserable now in my life. Why do I give valuable time?
Is there one story in here that really sort of reflects, in your view, the lyrics, the actual lyrics of the Smith song?
Funnily enough, there's a story by Willie Vlauten called Stop Me If You Think You've Heard This One Before. Mm-hmm. It's about a guy who takes up with a woman, and she's a high-maintenance other half, and makes his life a misery, really, and he does everything he can to make this woman happy, and he moves to a different town, gets a different job, changes his night shift to a day shift just so he can be there with her, and and does everything within his powers to make her happy and doesn't make her happy. And that struggle, that idea of a search for happiness and what happiness means, I think that really for me sums up the Smiths, because I know, again, there are people who don't get the Smiths, there are people for whom the Smiths are very miserable, and there are people who are fans who love the Smiths, who find them really happy and funny and to articulate things that other bands don't articulate. And because of that, I think that Willie's story really does a good job of existing in that area of talking about things that people don't talk about.
Peter Wilde, any idea how Morrissey feels about all of this, or what he might think about it?
Well, we sent copies of the book to Morrissey and to Johnny Marr. Johnny Marr we have heard back from, and we've been told that Johnny Marr likes the book, so that's very nice. Morrissey, we haven't heard anything from. However, I did a previous book in this series called Perverted by Language, Fiction Inspired by The Fall. The Fall are an English band who perhaps don't travel to the States quite so well. But in reaction to that book, Marquis Smith, the lead singer of The Fall, decried me from the stage, tore up copies of the book from the stage, sought to just pillory me from left to right, really, as much as she was able. And so I am taking silence to be a blessing.
That's Peter Wilde. He's the editor of the new book, Please, Fiction Inspired by the Smiths. He joined me from Manchester in England. Peter Wilde, thank you so much.
Thank you very much. I was detained, I was restrained.